The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors? Not just across town, but across the country. How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back to Global Reach. This is a show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in world markets. This week, we welcome the return of Paul Christopher, Chief International Strategist for Wells Fargo Advisors. Paul is just back from Singapore, Australia, and New Zealand, and he's going to share with us his observations and investment recommendations for the Southwest Pacific Rim and Southeast Asia. He'll also zero in on business opportunity and risk. We're also going to take a look at the dollar. We keep hearing that the dollar is losing its luster and that China, Russia, and some key emerging markets are chomping at the bit to find a replacement. So Paul is going to tell us whether there's any real risk to the dollar status as the premier world currency. Paul, welcome back to Global Reach.
Thank you, Tay. Great to be back with you.
Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore, but what are the other countries we're looking at?
Well, yeah, Singapore is part of ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. That includes Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, and a few other smaller ones.
And these are all countries that are really living in China's shadow.
Yes.
Oh, but there are also countries that are relatively small economies. Can they offer us big opportunities?
Well, I think if you take them collectively, the main point of the report of the trip is that these being small economies and markets, that means they're illiquid. So we don't want to try to buy individual companies there. I think it's probably better for your nighttime sleep if you not have to worry about those sorts of issues, and let a manager run it for you, but have it be broadly diversified and include those countries.
So that's his equity, but they're also, some of them are really thriving economies. And I would think for those of us in a number of services, technology, manufacturing, they also offer a lot of opportunities.
Yes. In fact, it's quite differentiated, too. So you have Singapore, which is an expensive place to live, but very service-oriented, high value add on the financial side, the financial services side. And then a place like Thailand, which is really attracting manufacturers who are interested in establishing assembly-type plants with low-wage labor.
Well, I think Vietnam is beginning to do that as well.
Yes, a little bit. Vietnam's a little bit more the Wild West. Thailand's had problems of its own, but of course, Vietnam, the institutional setup is a little bit less developed.
You know, before we go any further, I want to tell our listeners a little bit more about you. As I mentioned, Paul is the Chief International Strategist at Wells Fargo Advisors. He focuses on the international economic outlook, and he offers investment advice on currencies and on commodities. Before joining Wells Fargo Advisors, Paul developed economic strategies to trade in global financial and commodity futures market for Eclipse Capital Management. In previous positions, he supplied international economic perspectives for A.G. Edwards, and he advised institutional clients of Istanbul-based Global Securities on the oil-based economies of the Caucasus and Central Asia. In addition, he consulted with the governments of Hong Kong, Egypt, Russia, Kazakhstan, and the Kyrgyz Republic on monetary policy issues. And in addition to his appearances on Global Reach, clearly the most important, Paul has been frequently quoted by national media outlets such as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Forbes, Time, Investors Business Daily, USA Today, Bloomberg News, ABC News, NBC, CNBC, CNN-FM. So he's really one of the most popular guests they have, and I'm thrilled to have him back on Global Reach. Paul, when we look at these economies, you mentioned that manufacturing in Thailand, low-cost manufacturing center, but saying used to be if it was manufacturing, send it to China. If it was services, send it to India. Sounds like that model doesn't hold anymore.
That's right. I think a better one would still be location, location, location. Thailand is very well placed, not only on the trade routes, but very close to China, which has developed its manufacturing to the point now where it is looking for outsourcing opportunities.
So how dependent are these countries on their trade with China?
Well, the trade with China is one thing, exports, imports, and we look for all of them to begin exporting more of their goods and services into China. The exports from China have really gone above their heads, over their heads, to Europe and the United States. What's most interesting is how these countries are becoming part of the Chinese manufacturing or supply chain, and I think this is where you find opportunities for high-tech, niche manufacturers from the West to go into Thailand and to compete or to plug into China's manufacturing supply chain in that way.
So I know that you've written that there's an interest on China's part because these countries have lower wage rates, especially for basic manufacturing and assembly. But
yes.
How long can they enjoy that kind of low-wage advantage? I mean, China, the population they're drawing on for a workforce is still much bigger, and their interior provinces are still pretty poor. Mm-hmm. So why do the ASEAN countries have an advantage?
The advantage they have is really logistical. China has an enormous heartland, but it's not a lot of arable land, and it's not well developed infrastructure wise. It might take decades for China to get to the point where its interior is as competitive as Thailand, the Philippines, and Indonesia are today.
So they've got at least a couple of decades to sustain that low wage advantage.
In my opinion, yes. I think China probably needs 20 or 30,000 miles, 1,000 miles more of roads in its interior before it can develop the sort of transportation infrastructure, much less communications, that it needs to compete as well as it does in its coastal cities.
One of the things that came up on last week's show, I was interviewing Nate Sapayo, who's the editor of Alternative Emerging Investor. And he said they've been watching China, and China is trying to reestablish the old Silk Road as a trade route, but doing it in a 21st century context with rail, a lot of rail shipping, truck shipping. How much can that influence the region if that really takes off?
Well, it's important to see that that Silk Road that connects China with Europe via Central Asia, places I used to live in, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It's a two-way street. It's a two-way trade. So China's willing to send their manufacturers, but what it really wants is the energy resources that are located in Kazakhstan, in Iran, and in Turkmenistan. And that's going to take a while to do. These are even more Wild West, let's say, than Vietnam is, and China is still developing relationships with them. But I think this is an avenue that China definitely wants to pursue in order to just shorten its supply chain.
If we're thinking long term, first from the portfolio perspective, but then I want to talk about also from the business perspective, the manufacturing, the services. What do we look at on this Silk Road development? I mean, if China really wants to do it, and they seem to, they'll get to Southeast Asia first. So what are we looking at?
Well, I think what we're looking at really is the continued outsourcing of manufacturing, or looking for firms already in Thailand, Philippines, Vietnam, et cetera, that can connect into China's manufacturing supply chain. So again, Western businesses that have high tech or very well developed deep knowledge and value-add capability in certain manufacturing areas, high value-add manufacturing areas, high-tech, for example, biotech. Those are the sorts of firms that China is looking to connect with and exploit first in Southeast Asia, and then for more basic materials and eventually more low-cost labor, that would be Central Asia along your Silk Road.
How much of a driver is the China market for these countries? How dependent are they on China's manufacturing health, manufacturing sector health?
It's grown. I won't say it's been there all along. So it's relatively a new phenomenon, and it's more concentrated in Thailand than it is in Indonesia than it is, say, in Malaysia, which is more of a commodity exporter, or the Philippines, which its English language ability is more of a service call center sort of an operation. So it's not the sort of dependence that would bring down these countries if China has a recession, I think. But the Chinese connection goes deeper than that as well. It goes into flows of Chinese money into Southeast Asia, which we saw quite a bit of while we were there, in the form of Chinese investors looking for real estate and looking for investment opportunities, as well as entertainment and gambling and so forth.
It's
quite diversified.
Wow. Is China still trying to buy up all the access to commodities? I kind of broaden this into the Australian mining sector as well.
China does have strong interest in especially in Africa, to develop resources there. China's even made plays to offer to develop infrastructure for entire regions in particular countries if they can get access to the mineral resources in the ground. It's obviously quite a mutually advantageous trade.
Is this going to be the kind of infrastructure development we had in Africa during the colonial period, where it all goes from the mine to the port and doesn't do much else?
I suspect so, yes.
So what happens is, even with commodities, if you're exporting commodities to China, you're still depending on the health of that economy. What happens if manufacturing slows down, if this switch from unconstrained economic growth to a more competition and profit-driven growth model doesn't work well, and if the economy has a sharp or really sharp slowdown?
Yeah, I'm not as worried about it not working in the long run as I am that the transition may be bumpy and have disruptions for different economies in the short run, let's say the next year or two. But even with that, I think that China's going to have to continue to build. We talked a little bit about the road structure, the infrastructure that needs to be built in the middle of the country. China needs more homes. It needs more factories. It needs more schools and hospitals. It needs more roads to connect them, and it needs more communication. And all of that is going to require more raw materials. So instead of maybe growing at double-digit growth rates, China's consumption of raw materials and commodities may grow at single-digit growth rates, and I think that will continue to provide markets and opportunities for commodity suppliers.
So it's not really a case that, as they used to say with Mexico and the U.S., if the U.S. sneezes, Mexico catches cold.
Uh-huh.
Are the ASEAN countries a little more independent than that?
I think they are. They've already had, even before China became the sort of country that it is today, the economic giant that it is today, these countries have been well positioned to trade with Europe. They sit in a very interesting spot in the world geography between the Pacific Ocean and Europe, and trade does tend to flow from there into Europe and even to the Western United States. So they have domestic economies that are developing as well, developing domestic consumption.
I'm getting a signal. We've got to go to break. Hold that thought. We're going to dig much deeper into that when we come back from our break.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks.
We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the second segment of Global Reach. I'm here with my guest, Paul Christopher. He's Chief International Strategist for Wells Fargo Advisor, and we are talking about his observations and investment recommendations stemming from his recent trip to Singapore, Australia, and New Zealand. We're looking at Southeast Asia altogether. So you were talking when we went to break about how Southeast Asia is really well positioned between China and Europe. Give us a little bit more about what we should be looking for there.
Right. Well, these countries, the question came up in the context of how dependent are they or vulnerable are these countries to China? And my answer is I think they have a heavy dependence on China, but it's not 100%. These countries have they have domestic economies, domestic spending, and they're also quite developed. It's producing goods for export to Europe and the United States as well.
Okay. Let me look at the upside. What if China is really successful and one of its aims is to stimulate household spending, consumer spending? What's the upside for Southeast Asia, for New Zealand, for Australia?
Well, most immediately, it means more tourism. Chinese tourists are quite a common sight all across Southeast Asia and even into Australia, where the Australians are trying to catch up now with the Singaporeans by building their own multi-story, huge, over-the-top hotel and resort that will have a casino, just like the couple that are in Singapore. So China is quite interested in tourism across the area. And then, of course, you have agriculture.
I want to tell you a little bit more about tourism. What are the things that the Chinese traveler is really looking for when they're picking their tourist destination? What kind of luxuries?
They're looking for beaches, and they're looking for gambling opportunities. Gambling is quite a pastime in China, and they're looking for high-level global class hotels and resorts to go to, complete with with the food and the luxury suites for the gamblers.
Do you need to do anything special to? Did you see anything when you were at those hotels that specially would appeal to the Chinese as opposed to, say, the American or European traveler?
Well, the casinos are the huge draw. The minimum bet on the baccarat table, they tell me, was $50. I was going to go down and play a little, but that was too rich for me even to start. And that attracts the high rollers from China who also come there looking for the luxury accommodations, the presidential suite, for instance, with 5,000 square feet of room, a grand piano, a sauna, a private hair salon, and of course, a karaoke room, soundproofed.
Wow. Wow. So you were saying something about agriculture as a key sector.
This is also very important. China really cannot feed itself, and it has an ongoing problem that it's arable land is also the place where most people want to live. So you either build the hotel or build the apartment building, rather, or you grow crops. And in the case of China, they've chosen in many cases to expand the residential space. And that means they rely more on food imports. And that's going to come from places like Malaysia, from Indonesia, and also from New Zealand.
And Vietnam.
And Vietnam as well. Yes, that's right. Really across the regions. So food is going to be an increasingly important import for China from this region.
So are they going to be, are these countries shipping out just straight food commodity?
Yes,
are we going
to
see a move?
They will ship out food. They will ship out food commodities and especially animal feed. So corn is a big import to China. So is soybeans, and a lot of that is consumed by the animals that end up being eaten.
What about opportunities for processed food? Certainly, when countries are moving from commodity into manufacturing, that's one of the ways they're moving up the value chain.
Yes, that's right. It's maybe my impression is that that's somewhat less well developed in that region and less well developed in China. And of course, they have a lot of food safety issues in China. It's one of the reasons they brought the New Zealanders into China to build their dairy industry, rebuild it from the ground up.
Yeah, I remember that food scandal where particularly milk for children.
Yes.
Was poisoned, and then people lost children over it.
Horrific, yes.
So I also remember the pet food adulteration.
Right, and it's all because of the chemicals, the additives that were put in that weren't adequately screened or tested.
Actually, a couple weeks ago, we spoke about somebody who's making a business in China in terms of advising Chinese food manufacturers how to meet international standards. Do you see these countries moving up the value-added scale? So, for example, do you see the New Zealanders going beyond powdered milk and trying to get, you know, more exotic or more interesting processed food?
Right. New Zealand and Australia, interesting places. They're very attractive in some senses, but need to improve their productivity dramatically. And I think one way that New Zealand needs or could do this is by moving up from simply emphasizing milk and powdered milk, which China buys a lot of, to nutrition drinks, which are crazy popular in Asia and command higher prices than ordinary milk, of course. But the New Zealanders haven't really made that move into that area yet.
I keep thinking about Vietnam. Between their ties to China and their French sophistication, I think there's a lot of room in their processed food industry or the food processing industry for investment in new businesses.
Yes, that's very true. Vietnam's real issues are a couple. One is its lack of institutional development, especially monetary policy. The currency has a tendency to fluctuate quite widely. And the other problem is their historical antipathy towards China or problems with the border with China.
Speaking of problems with the border, China has given some indications recently that it doesn't regard its present borders as fixed, including its land borders, not just the islands.
Yes, that's right. It's an issue with a number of countries, including India and Vietnam.
What kind of disruption could that be to the whole economic picture there?
It's potentially a large disruption, but I think the Chinese like to move incrementally on many, many things, including foreign policy. So I'm not expecting that this is an imminent source of violence, but it will be something that diplomatically still has to be worked out, and that diplomatic tension could spill over into some commercial hurdles.
You mentioned India. Is India a good market for the ASEAN countries? Or is it primarily a low-wage competitor?
It is primarily a low-wage competitor, although India will buy raw materials, commodities, from places like Malaysia and Indonesia.
We've had a lot of the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the news. And I've also seen articles kind of warning the settlers, saying that the Southeast Asian countries could actually lose big if this thing goes through. What's your take on it?
Yeah, that's a potential competitor to Southeast Asia, unless they can get in on the deal, and I'm not sure where that stands. But the Southeast Asian countries really need to expand their openness to other countries, especially through these sorts of arrangements.
Have they been taking, you mentioned investment, bricks and mortar investment. I saw a note somewhere that in your report that Vietnam had taken some steps to make itself a more attractive place for doing business.
Right. The process of starting a business in Vietnam has been very lengthy, as it is in many countries, and that is being simplified.
Oh, that's always a good sign. In terms of outside investment, how heavily dependent are these ASEAN economies, Australia, New Zealand, how dependent are they on investment, on capital flows from the global investment community?
They, like most emerging countries, the ASEAN countries, and even Singapore and Australia, depend quite heavily on inflows. The inflows that have come about as a result of low interest rates in places like Japan, Europe, and the United States have sent investors from those developed areas with their money looking for better yielding opportunities all around the globe. That money has found itself in many cases, especially in Southeast Asia and Australia, in New Zealand, into housing, where it's not gone necessarily to build new houses, it's gone to bid up the prices of existing homes.
So is that the kind of, are they creating the kind of housing bubble we saw in the U.S., in Japan?
It's not a speculative bubble. We have to remember that in these countries, there are tax advantages to owning homes that are then rented out to people. So there are even Australians who own rental property, and that rental property sits in their government-recognized retirement plan. So these are people young people in many cases, who live in an apartment but rent out a much nicer place in order to collect the rent proceeds from it. These are investments that are being inhabited. We're not talking about speculative investments in housing that may or may not be paid off.
So you're not seeing something that could burst the price bubble so that these assets will go down in value as we saw in the U.S.?
Well, if you had, for example, in Australia, if you had a big increase in the unemployment rate, then you might see some material impact on rental payments, and you might see some loans go bad and some banks come under a little bit of pressure. But it's not, I think, a bubble. It's simply high prices for assets that may or may not continue to rise.
So is that forcing sort of the ordinary worker then into only rental housing? Are they out of the housing market?
Yeah, many workers cannot afford to live in downtown Sydney or in New Zealand in downtown Auckland, and there's been some development and some new housing starting in the outskirts of these cities. One of the big problems is, as I saw last year in Sweden, as a matter of fact, one of the big problems is zoning. The local authorities have very strict zoning laws, which prevents the supply from increasing as rapidly as the demand, and that is again another source of gain in home prices and another important difference with the United States in 2008.
So we've got to go to break now. When we get back, I want to see what other clouds might be on the horizon for this area. Don't go away, and then we're going to talk about the dollar.
Okay.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the third segment of Global Reach. This is your host, Tay Revez, and I am here with my guest, Paul Christopher, Chief International Strategist for Wells Fargo Advisors. Paul, when we went to break, we were talking about the fact that a lot of savings have been diverted into housing, drives up the cost of living, and I think you mentioned that it's accentuating income inequalities. That's a big topic in many corners of the globe today, not the least the U.S. But the International Monetary Fund is highlighting that there is a real serious threat to the global economy from growing income inequality around the world. In fact, Christine Lagarde, the director of the IMF, has been talking about that quite a bit lately. How much is this a factor in the ASEAN countries?
This is an important factor, I think, in the ASEAN countries. Singapore is maybe the best example of income inequality, where the expats on the island have managed to come in with a lot of their own money and really bid up the prices of goods and services to the point where the locals are unhappy and are beginning to demand changes from the government in order to equalize the opportunities.
How is the government responding?
Well, the government is trying to, as most governments do, they give subsidies to those who really need it the most, but they're also trying to control inflation in food prices, and they're trying to impose higher taxes, especially in automobiles, in order to redistribute some of the wealth.
They have huge taxes on automobiles, don't they?
Yes. It being an island, they decided a while ago that that they would try to really limit the number of roads that had to be built and the cars and the parking spaces that would be needed. So, for example, a mid-sized car that might cost $30,000, a sedan, might have a $70,000 fee for the license plate. A luxury car with a larger engine would go up accordingly.
How are bicycles doing? That's amazing. So what about some of the other countries? We've been seeing a lot of unrest in Thailand, demanding that the prime minister go. And I understand yesterday last week she stepped down. I'm not sure if she's standing for re-election, but...
Yeah, there's a serious deep division in Thailand where the influx of new manufacturing has created dramatic wealth for a few, while many who haven't enjoyed wage increases yet continue to languish. And it's pitted the northern part of the country where people have done relatively better against the southern part of the country. And the lightning rod for this is the former prime minister who's sent out of the country, who was forced into exile, but he's promised that there would be full equality and that they would take whatever steps were necessary in order to improve the income distribution, and that was very much against the wishes of the landed and capitalists who have allied themselves more with the royal family. So it's a real serious problem in Thailand. It's broken out into demonstrations and violence.
What is that doing to their tourism industry, which is very attractive, particularly to the Europeans?
Yeah, it's difficult to tell that there's much impact on tourism because that continues to thrive. But you're probably not far away from a disruption in tourism if the violence were to escalate.
What about Indonesia? We haven't talked much about that. That's a huge country.
Yeah. yes, the largest Muslim country, 17,000 islands. Their real problem is the lack of productivity and efficiency comes from the fact that everything, the country is so spread out with so much water separating one group of people from another group of people. So you really need much better infrastructure than they currently have. And they were working on that until the global financial crisis came, and that's really sucked resources away from the infrastructure development and moves by the government to try to heal income inequality.
In the past, there were some very deep divisions and actual violence between the Muslim population and the Indonesians of Chinese heritage. Is that still evidenced in any way, or is that gone and forgotten?
No, not by any means gone and forgotten. And it's not just a problem in Indonesia. It's a serious problem in Malaysia as well, where there have been laws passed that explicitly favor native Malaysians, again, or ethnic Malaysians, I should say, against ethnic Chinese.
The Bumiputra laws.
Yes, exactly.
So, speaking of Malaysia, do you think there's going to be any fallout and unrest over the flight in terms of the way the government handled it?
Yes, I do. This is a big global issue. It's embarrassing, not to mention, of course, the very important fact that many Malaysians and Malaysian families lost loved ones on that flight. It's a difficult situation. One can accuse the government of some inexperience or ineptitude, but it's just a very difficult technological problem to solve.
You mentioned that there is a need to improve productivity. And somehow this was a byproduct of the fact that they've had strong foreign capital inflows. I'm not sure I see the connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you have these strong inflows, they tend to lower interest rates. People are coming in from overseas and buying bonds. They're buying stocks. And that lowers the cost of money since there's so much money around. And firms really find it, in such a circumstance, almost irresistible to borrow money in order to expand production rather than become more efficient and cut costs. And so that's happened across the board in Singapore, in the rest of Southeast Asia, as well as Australia and New Zealand. And all of these countries in our findings really need to do much more to improve their efficiency in order to, and this will help solve the income inequality as well by raising wages once workers start to get more efficient.
So looking at the region kind of as a whole and its parts, what are some of your recommendations in terms of the investment outlook?
Mm-hmm.
Start with equities.
Starting with equities, the general point for all of the countries we visited is that all of them, even Australia and New Zealand, are relatively small economies and markets, and therefore we would prefer that investors, retail investors especially, long-term retail investors, should take a broadly diversified approach. So buy that broadly diversified mutual fund or exchange-traded product that includes Singapore, Australia, and New Zealand, and by doing so, you'll not only solve some of the problem of these being illiquid markets and small, but you'll also enjoy the diversification benefits that come from each one of those being so different and so differently specialized. The same is true on the emerging side for the ASEAN countries.
Okay, what about in the commodity field? Are we seeing a rebound of commodity prices?
In commodities, there's been something of a rebound in the first part of this year. We don't think it has strong legs under it, and that by the middle of the year, we'll see some strong increases in supply that will increase inventories, especially in industrial metals and energy, and that those inventory overhangs will eventually take commodity prices back lower. I think the same is true broadly in agriculture, where investors, buyers of agricultural products, futures contracts, I should say, have bid up prices because of fears of a drought in Brazil, but I think they're neglecting that global stocks in these grains and products are still widely adequate for the world, and that the supply response in the coming year, additional plantings, will really push prices lower once more. So we would underweight commodities. That means hold less than one's target allocation.
Okay. You talked about a lot of the infrastructure needs. Not a portfolio investment per se, or it might be, but do you see opportunities coming out of the infrastructure needs of these economies?
Yes, the Australians are continuing to build out their mining infrastructure, but that's going to come to an end, we think, probably next year. They have a great opportunity to improve their road infrastructure, as do the New Zealanders, who also need a lot of work on water processing, water management, and electricity grid, that is to say distribution. The ASEAN countries are, you check all the boxes, they need the roads, the ports, the bridges, the schools. They need a lot of building. They also need a lot of communication development.
So all the materials then, as well as infrastructure finance, project management, is the finance going to be there for it? Is the money there for it?
On a selective basis, but certainly right now that's not really a problem. But I foresee that the finance will get to be more of a problem. The key factors to watch there will be the yields on treasuries in this country and the value of the dollar. As those rise, the financing in emerging markets and overseas in general will tend to decline.
Of course, it'd be nice to know if there was money for infrastructure in the United States, given the state of so many of its bridges. What about currencies? Is there an investment opportunity there?
Once again, for people who are interested in making a pure currency play, as opposed to simply buying the stocks in local currencies, you could buy a CD, for instance, in Australia or New Zealand or Singapore. Those pure currency plays are probably best handled through a fund. But here again, I might ask the investor to think about whether he or she is really interested in just the currency by itself, or maybe whether the equity or the bond investment to go along with it would add a second potential source of return.
What about sovereign debt? Do I want to buy sovereign debt in local currency? Do I want to buy their sovereign debt at all?
You'll find that the markets for sovereign debt across Asia are rather small. They're developing, but they're still rather small. New Zealand and Australia are different. They come from the British tradition, and debt is more developed, more established there. The problem is that many people have been buying Australian, New Zealand government debt and corporates for a number of years now since the crisis because their yields were so much better than treasuries and their currencies were rising. I think the yields have come down quite a bit, still better than treasuries, but they've come down a lot. And more importantly, I think the currencies are about to roll over. So if an investor is holding a New Zealand or an Australian government bond, I would continue to hold it. But I wouldn't buy new at this point. I would wait for your bond to mature, cash it out, and then wait for the currencies to hit something in the mid to low 80s against the dollar before one buys.
Currencies are going to roll over, you mean their currencies are going to fall?
Oh, yes. I think their currencies will fall against the dollar. The New Zealand dollar is up almost to parity against the U.S. dollar, and the Australian dollar is in the mid-90s, 95 U.S. cents per Australian dollar. I think that currency should really be back more like 82, 83. That's where I'd be looking to buy.
Speaking of the dollar, there are a lot of people attacking the dollar and possibly looking for alternatives. So when we get back, we have to go to break now, but when we come back from the break, I want to talk about, is there a real risk to the status of the U.S. dollar as the world's premier currency? We'll do that right after break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to our final segment. This is Global Reach, and I'm your host, Tay Revez, and I am here with Paul Christopher, Chief International Strategist of Wells Fargo Advisors. When we went to break, we were starting to talk dollars. So is the luster really faded on the U.S. dollar? There's so much concern. It's been the world's premier currency since, you know, mid-century. Is that going to continue?
We think it will. There's really no other currency or combination of currencies that can do what the dollar does. That is to say, be available everywhere in the world with a modest spread between buying and selling prices and really be available to anyone who wants it, anywhere one wants it.
So who's trying to dethrone the dollar?
Well, it's not really in the interest of anyone to dethrone the dollar right now, but there are a number of places in the world that are trying to assert their own currencies more into the international trading scheme, principally China. China has had its currency locked behind doors for many years and now wants to get its currency out and available and traded in the world. Some people mistake the trade agreements that China has signed where the Chinese currency or the Brazilian currency is to be used in the transaction instead of dollars. They've mistaken that.
Paul, wait a sec. You're assuming our audience knows about these trade agreements. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
Oh, I'm sorry. So China has made agreements with Brazil, among others. So, for example, the Chinese deal with Brazil is, okay, we'll buy your iron ore, your soybeans, and we'll take either renminbis, that is to say that we'll pay you in our own currency, or we can do business in the Brazilian real. And some people have taken this deal as a sign that the Chinese and the Brazilians are trying to squeeze the dollar out of the world system. But really, it's more about getting the renminbi, the Chinese currency, into the world system. The Chinese are in no position to replace the dollar with their own currency.
Isn't it also more like trying to lock the Brazilians into further trade relations with China? Because the Brazilian real is also not an international currency. I mean, where are they going to spend these currencies if not in China and Brazil?
That's a very good point. They also want to make the Brazilian real more available, and they want to encourage the Brazilians to do a lot of their business directly in their own currency, which eliminates some of the uncertainty in prices.
I remember this goes back a long time ago. Goes back to the when Nixon decoupled the dollar and gold. I had a friend who was with the Indian government, and he just said, you know, the U.S. just cost us 20% of our foreign reserves because they were holding a lot of dollars. How much of a concern is there of devaluing the dollar? I mean, I watch the dollar euro very closely because I do a lot of business in the euro, and I've got euro payments sometimes scheduled a year out. And the euro has been really strong against the dollar. It went up as high as 1.39. Plus, in the last week, it's back down to about a penny and a half now. But how much trouble is the dollar in?
I would say that the dollar is not really in trouble at all. What we're seeing with this, and I would call it resilience on the part of the euro, what we're really seeing here is a difference in monetary policies The Fed here in this country has been very aggressive in printing money, whereas the European Central Bank has been very loath to come up with aggressive measures to stimulate its own economy. That has helped the euro in the short run. The difference in money supplies has helped the euro in the short run. I think it's going to be a serious deficiency for the euro, or a disadvantage in the longer run, as that economy struggles to get back on its feet, much more so than in the United States.
So could the euro take a bigger role in the world of currencies? This one is about 30% now?
Yes, that's about right. Uh-huh. Yeah, about 5 years ago, I would have said, sure, that's a real a growing possibility, and it's even a trend. But the euro crisis has really damaged the credibility, not just of the euro, but of the policy-making framework in which the euro is managed. I don't think the euro is really a significant threat to the dollar any more than the yen is.
It also might be almost nice if there was another currency. What about this whole issue of a basket of Asian currencies? Is there any possibility that that could, you know, take a larger role?
Some people have proposed that that international transactions be carried out with a basket of currencies. So you would trade, let's say, a Taiwanese dollar for a combination of other Asian currencies, or perhaps the euro, the yen, the pound sterling, and something else. But this is not practical at all. Imagine if you were a business person in Taiwan trying to buy some Argentine wine, and you would have to take your Taiwanese dollar and buy four other currencies instead of one, and of course there are commissions associated with each currency that you buy. It's just not practical to ask business people to pay four times the commission, and maybe even more than that if you're buying currencies that aren't as liquid as the dollar, and just in order to do ordinary business. It really takes a big hit or a big chunk out of margins.
You know, when they created the euro, somebody did the math on what it would take to start out with a dollar and then go in and out of every currency in Europe. I think they were left with something like 46 cents by the time they were finished. But a basket of currencies, what about, well, here's a basket of currencies that exists already, special drawing rights.
Right. The special drawing right was really created in the first place to be an accounting entry. It wasn't created to be something that people exchange. It's even difficult to explain what a special drawing right is to an ordinary person. It's difficult to imagine how someone would take it down around the corner to buy a gallon of milk with.
What about gold? Although doesn't seem to be enough gold to go around.
That's the main problem. Gold has for centuries been used by itself as money. In the last century, it was used as the basis for money. But if your gold stock in the world increases by only 2% a year, that means, at least in principle, your money supply can only increase by 2% a year. Go tell a growing small business that it can't have a loan because the gold supply is only going up by 2% a year. That's what brought us William Jennings Bryan and the Cross of Gold speech in the late 1800s.
I shall not, nail my countrymen to a cross of gold.
Cross of gold, yeah.
Before we leave, we've only got a couple minutes till the end of the show, believe it or not. You put out a paper looking at Europe and saying their economies are beginning to recover. But the European Commissioner for Economic and Monetary Affairs, Siim Kallas, has said if the sanctions get bigger against Russia, the economy could be really hurt. Are you concerned about the European economies?
If we were to see a civil war, a conflict that goes out of control in eastern Ukraine, then yes, I think we could see energy disruptions to Western Europe or sanctions, and either one or any combination would really damage this fledgling recovery.
Paul, real quick, what are the two most important takeaways from our conversation today? What do our listeners need to do on Monday?
What you really need to do on Monday is go out and buy stocks before bonds, and focus on the U.S. first, Europe and Japan next, and emerging markets last.
Okay. So how can our listeners find you?
On the web at www.wellsfargoadvisors.com, wellsfargoadvisors.com.
Well, I think this is a great show. Thank you. There's a lot of really valuable insight and information in this.
My pleasure.
And for our listeners, if you'd like to suggest a topic or a guest for future episodes, please let me know at trr@globalreach-sbi.com. trr@globalreach-stephenboyicecream.com. Right now, on behalf of Paul and myself, we want to thank you for listening, and we wish you great success in extending your global reach. Tune in next week.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.